morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio has been re-elected to a second five-year term.
I, Julius Maada Bio, do hereby, in the name of God, swear that I will at all times wear and truly discharge the duties of the office of the President of the Republic of Sierra Leone, so help me God.
A Liberian election observer tells us about the lessons for his own country as it prepares for election in October this year. Zimbabwe's inflation hits 178% as its currency continues crashing against the U.S. dollar. Namibia's High Court says the country's mines minister did not have the power to cancel the license of a Chinese lithium mining company. The general of Sudan's RSF militia announces a new 48-hour ceasefire for the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha starting today, Wednesday.
He says it is his wish that these days will be used for a genuine forgiveness and reconciliation among the people.
And plans by a UN agency to cut food aid for refugees in Uganda are expected to worsen their struggle for hunger. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio has been re-elected to his second five-year term. The announcement was made Tuesday when the country's Electoral Commission announced the final results of Saturday's presidential elections. The main opposition All People's Congress Party has rejected the results. As Kelvin Lewis reports from Freetown, President Bio has called on the opposition to work with him.
I, Julius Maada Bio, do hereby, in the name of God, swear that I will at all times wear and truly discharge the duties of the office of the President of the Republic of Sierra Leone according to law. So help me God.
Earlier in the day, the main opposition candidate, Samura Kamara, had released a statement in which he reaffirmed his party's total rejection of what he called the skewed, manipulated, and unverified 60% partial results. In his speech, to begin his second term as president, Julius Maada Bio said his victory belongs to all Sierra Leoneans. He then reached out to the opposition leader.
Our victory today is not just mine. It belongs to every Sierra Leonean who dreams of a brighter and better future for our nation, the land that we love. I therefore extend the hand of fellowship to my dear brother and foremost opposition leader, Dr. Samora Kamara of the All People's Congress Party, to join us in the arduous task of nation building. The job ahead is enormous, but collectively we can build the country of our dreams. The Sierra Leone our current and future generations deserve.
Earlier, Chief Electoral Commissioner Mohamed Kone announced Bio as winner of the presidential elections.
Therefore, by the powers vested in me as the National Returning Officer, by Section 67, 51(2) and 92(4) of the Public Elections Act 2022, Act Number 17 of 2022, and pursuant to Section 42(2)(e) of the Constitution of Sierra Leone 1991, Act Number 6 of 1991, I hereby certify that Bio Julius Maada, having pulled 1,566,932 of the valid vote cast, representing 56.17% of the total valid vote cast in the 24th June 2023 presidential election, duly elected President of the Republic.
Despite calling on his supporters to celebrate responsibly, the streets of the capital were soon full with supporters chanting the name of the newly sworn-in president. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
A Liberian lawyer says one of the lessons he learned from observing Sierra Leone's June 24 presidential and parliamentary contest is that Liberians must fully participate in the election of their local and national leaders. Samuel Kofi Woods is a member of the West African Independent Election Observer Group that has just observed the Sierra Leone polls. As Liberia readies for presidential vote in October, Woods also says the National Elections Commission must play a neutral role in the organization of the polls. He also says civil society and individual citizens must get involved in voter education.
Well, on the day of elections, our observation is that the election went peacefully and there was enthusiasm of the citizens to vote. And I will say to you that we only observed the day of election. So that's our conclusion. We hope that Sierra Leoneans can build upon that and work towards peace and development. As I said, generally, the election went peacefully. There was calm around the various polling centers in urban and rural Freetown where we were deployed. Yes, as I indicated, there were incidents of delays in the polling, but one can say on the overall, it was peaceful.
You are from Liberia, although you are there in Sierra Leone representing the West Africa Election Observer Mission there. As Liberia prepares to go to election in October this year, what lessons do you think Liberia can learn from the Sierra Leone situation?
Firstly, all Liberians, citizens, political parties, civil society, and all stakeholders must take ownership of the process of elections and see it as a process that could lead to the development and to the peace of our country. That's one. Two, everyone must get involved in civic and voters' education and make sure that we all vote, because each vote will count and the value of our vote will determine the leadership of our country. Three, the Election Commission, which is the mechanism, must ensure and demonstrate a level of neutrality and ensure that they can inspire and guarantee the trust of the electorate by the very act, the conduct of the process as it proceeds.
As it stands now, the National Elections Commission of Liberia, what do you think so far with about 3-4 months left before? How is it doing in the preparation leading up to the election?
Well, as you know, James, I'm not directly involved, but the conversation I've had with some of the political parties' leaders, they continue to express concerns about issues around the biometric voter registration and other issues that have come up. I think there are efforts to have them addressed, but I believe the Election Commission must continue with the intra-party dialogue so that issues can be addressed as they are raised by political parties and citizens alike. But mainly, I believe that a more aggressive, very aggressive voter education exercise must be undertaken in the country to ensure that people are educated about what to do, where to do it, when to do it, especially on voting day. That is very critical.
Samuel Kofi Woods is a Liberian lawyer and a member of the West African Independent Election Observer Group. He was speaking with me from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. The leader of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces announced a 48-hour ceasefire starting today, Wednesday, for the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo also said he would hold his forces accountable for violations against civilians since the breakout of the war against Sudan's military. But analysts are skeptical after numerous failed ceasefires and note Dagalo's poor record on rights violations. Michael Atit reports from Juba, neighboring South Sudan.
The commander of the Sudan paramilitary rapid support forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Himeti, announced the 48-hour ceasefire for Al-Adha festivities from early Wednesday morning through Thursday night. In an audio address provided to VOA by the Al-Hadas TV channel, Himeti declared a two-day unilateral truce honoring the Muslims' Adha festivity. He says his forces will remain in their position and will act only in self-defense. Himeti notes the unilateral ceasefire shows the commitment of his forces to end fighting and end the suffering of civilians. He says it is his wish that these days will be used for a genuine forgiveness and reconciliation among the people. He cited a deep feeling for the people who are suffering and going through harsh humanitarian situations because of the ongoing fighting which has affected their livelihoods. He said they are determined to end this war, hopefully strong and united once again. However, the RSF commander expressed concern about the alleged human rights violations committed by his forces against civilians. He announced the establishment of field courts headed by Major General Hassam Saleh Fidel to carry out investigations into claims of offenses allegedly committed by the RSF. He says the violations are against the RSF law and the instructions of its senior leadership. We are going to address them firmly and seriously, Himeti says. I'm here sincerely assuring our people that we reject and condemn any violation against civilians, including those believed to have been committed by our RSF forces. VOA conducted Al-Tahir Abu Haja, the head of the media and information in the office of the Sovereign Council Chairman and the Army Chief Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, for comment on this report, but Abu Haja did not answer. Speaking to VOA on Tuesday, Muhammad Khalil, a retired military officer and a lecturer of international relations at various Sudanese universities, downplayed the unilateral ceasefire announced by the RSF. Khalil says the ceasefire is meant to please the international community and civilians will still experience looting of their property, theft and intimidation. Khalil said he does not think the ceasefire is meant for civilians, because civilians have left their houses and their property is being looted by the RSF and sold cheaply in local markets in RSF-controlled areas within Khartoum and elsewhere. The UN says about 2.5 million people have been displaced in and out of Sudan since the outset of the conflict on October 15th. Nearly 2 million people are internally displaced. Michael Atit for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 28th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Zimbabwe officials say the country's annual inflation rate more than doubled from May to June to more than 175%. Economists say multiple devaluations of Zimbabwe's struggling dollar led prices to surge. Average citizens are feeling the pinch, as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Average Zimbabweans are feeling the effects of the country's weak currency, known as bond notes, or ZWL, which has been losing value against the US dollar. 40-year-old Kathleen Masquera says her salary in local currency has lost about 70% of its value since the beginning of the year. She has been begging her employer to revise her pay.
So it's very difficult. Everything is just going up. You know, you get into the shop and you're shocked the next time. The rates has changed, everything has changed. So it's just tough. I take care of school going kids. I also take care of my niece who's not employed right now. So it's very tough. I have to work on contracts, and all the money that I get is like from hand to mouth. So it's quite difficult at the moment.
Taguma Mahonde, the Director General of the Zimbabwe National Statistics Agency, says the country's inflation rate remains high and accelerated this month.
The month-on-month inflation rate in June 2023 was 74.5%, gaining 58.8 percentage points on the May 2023 rate of 15.7%. The year-on-year inflation rate for the month of June 2023 was, as measured by the All Items Consumer Price Index, was 175.8%.
Trust Chikora is a businessman and economic commentator, as well as former president of Zimbabwe, National Chamber of Commerce. He says the rising figures of inflation is because of the local currency, which has been losing value against the US dollar, forcing prices to go up. On a positive note, he says the inflation rate may soon start heading down.
Maybe it would start to even out as we move forward in July and beyond, especially if the government continues with the measures they've been putting in place now, minimizing activity on the parallel market, to have a situation hopefully where interest rates are higher than inflation. Money supply growth needs to be curtailed so that government is not pumping Zim dollar money into the market.
That would be surely good news for average Zimbabweans whose wages can't keep up with the rising prices at the market. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A Namibian human rights activist says African countries with vast mineral and other natural resources from his country's management of its mineral resources. Earlier this month, Namibia banned the export of unprocessed lithium and other important minerals as part of efforts to encourage local processing. In a related development, Namibia's High Court ruled on Tuesday that the country's mines minister did not have the power to cancel the license of a Chinese lithium mining company, Zinfeng, without first asking the judiciary to revoke the previous agreement. Phil Yanagula is executive director of Namibia Rights. He tells me that while safeguarding the exploitation of Namibia's resources is important, it must be done within the laws of the country.
Namibia is a state governed on three main principles. One is democracy. The second is the rule of law, and then the third, justice for all. The second constitutional principle is, it is under Article 18 of the Namibian Constitution, which stipulates that administrative bodies, such as ministries and or administrative officials, such as the Minister of Mines and Energy, must act reasonably and lawfully and comply with the common law and legislation. So, under those circumstances, the Minister of Mines and Energy, according to the governing legislation, does not have authority to revoke the license to the Chinese company.
But the minister said he revoked the license because the company obtained the license after a flawed application process. Doesn't he have the right to come back to review his own decision?
Not at all. Not at all. Under the governing law with which the minister must comply, stipulates, according to the judge, that the minister must approach the court for that decision. He cannot do that himself.
It seems there has been some dispute or conflict between the Chinese mining company and the Namibian government. The Namibian government is banning the company from exporting unprocessed lithium. What is going on?
The government, I think, in that case is right to guard its resources because the government is a custodian on behalf of the Namibian state of mineral resources and all other resources under the sun in Namibia. Therein, the government is quite correct. The problem is the procedure, how to go about it to cancel the license accorded to the Chinese company.
What lessons do you think other African countries with vast deposits of minerals and other natural resources can draw from the Namibian experience?
I would really advise all African countries to guard their mineral resources, because now in the world of competition, you cannot survive if you are not guarding the resources of your country to benefit your own population. But at the same time, the rule of law must be observed.
Phil Yanagolo is the executive director of Namibia Rights. He was speaking with us from the capital, Windhoek. plans by a United Nations agency to cut food aid from July 1st for refugees in Uganda, Africa's biggest refugee host, are expected to worsen their struggle with food shortages from climate change. The UN's World Food Program says aid cuts leave them no choice but to help only the most vulnerable. Halima Atumani reports from Palorinya refugee camp in Obongi District, Uganda.
In Uganda's Palorinya refugee camp, gardens are filled with corn, but there will be little to harvest. Father of nine, Eid Alfred, says in the past his garden yielded 2 bags of corn, but with the prolonged drought this year, he expects nothing. He says, when you look at these crops, they are not drought resistant. They need constant rain for a good harvest. Without rain, he says, I won't get anything. They will die completely. The UN's refugee agency says Uganda is home to more than 1.5 million refugees and asylum seekers, making it the largest host in Africa. Uganda's government provides each family with a 9-by-9-meter plot for a house and a small garden. But it's not enough to survive for refugee families like mother of five, Naima Poni, who treks to the border with South Sudan to buy food.
The food is very little. My children is now growing. They're eating too much. Even though no food, food is not enough.
The UN says it has only received 27% of the funding needed for refugees in Uganda, so it has been forced to switch for the first time to targeted assistance from July 1st. Households considered most vulnerable, such as those headed by women or the chronically ill, will receive 60% of the recommended monthly food ration. Other refugees will get just 30%. The World Food Program's Deputy Director for Uganda, Marcus Pryor, says officials will keep a close watch for serious negative impacts from the food cuts.
We'll look at things like people's food consumption, we'll look at malnutrition rates, we'll look at the kind of survival strategies that refugees resort to if they are in difficulties. And this will allow us to take our case to those who support the World Food Programme and the refugee response more broadly.
Refugee leader Kenyi Moses says he is already seeing an impact from the drought and food aid cuts. Some refugees are leaving.
Most of our households right now, they were only left in the hands of younger
children. He says most of our households right now were left in the hands of young children. He says most of our people have gone back to South Sudan, well knowing the situation there is not favorable. He says these children alone cannot be heads of the family. The World Food Program in Uganda says it needs at least $64 million to support the refugees until the end of the year. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Palorinya Refugee Camp in Obongi District, Uganda.
Fleeing drought and conflict in Somalia, refugees have been pouring into the Dadaab refugee camps in neighboring Kenya. Humanitarian agencies say the influx of people has strained services in the already overcrowded camps and are warning of health risks. Juma Majanga reports from the Dadaab camps.
At a temporary resettlement for yet-to-be-registered refugees in Dagahale, one of the 5 camps that make up the Dadaab complex, Shankaro Abukar and her family are still reeling from the effects of a cholera outbreak. In November, Abukar lost a child to cholera after she and 4 of her children had come down with the disease. Last month, the mother of 11 was again taken ill with the disease together with 4 of her children. Speaking with visible anger, Abukar says if the children are alive today, it is only because they are surviving on milk and water. And sometimes she says they don't even have that. They are living with a lot of problems, she says, and she feels so much pain as a mother not being able to help her children with anything. She says only God can take away her pain since they don't have anyone to help them. Hassan Ibrahim is Abukar's husband. Ibrahim says that they face a lot of challenges in the temporary resettlement, the main one being a lack of sanitation facilities. He says all refugees in the settlement share one latrine, and that is leading to poor hygiene conditions and exposing the refugees to communicable diseases, Juma. Majanga for VOA News, Dadaab Refugee Camps, Kenya.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am...